Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Sandy Clark, and in this episode, I had a conversation with Buddhist monk and Pali language scholar Ajahn Brahmali on the idea of acceptance as we discussed what it is, what it's not, and why we can often struggle with acceptance when it comes to our own thoughts, feelings, and emotions. Ajahn Brahmali is originally from Norway and has been a monk for over 25 years. He was fully ordained as a monk by Ajahn Brahm in 1996 at Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth. And many people in Malaysia will be familiar with both of these respected teachers who regularly visit Malaysia to deliver talks and retreats to the local Buddhist community. Starting off our conversation, I asked Ajahn Brahmali, why is it that we find acceptance so difficult when it comes to our thoughts and feelings? And what happens when we can begin to work toward acceptance of what shows up within ourselves?
I think there's probably a number of things, but I think one thing that is very important is the fact that we have vested interest in things. We have certain things that we are attached to, a certain outlook, a certain worldview, a certain idea about ourselves, who we are as human beings. And then when when things change or we are challenged with those ideas, those vested interests, then actually it is very difficult to accept that change, because we want things to be one way, the world is a different way, and then there's a clash between the two. And that distance between the way things are and the way we want things to be, that is really the problem. That is kind of where acceptance lies. So there's a couple of things that we need to do, in a sense. It is hard precisely because we don't appreciate things the way they are. So we need to kind of reflect on the way the world is so that we can kind of approach that way. But the other thing is to build up a sense of inner resilience, so that we actually have some strong qualities inside, that when we are challenged with these difficult things, then we can actually deal with it in a much better way, because we have the qualities that are required to deal with difficult situations, basically. Something like that, I would say, yeah.
So this is a sense of being caught up in how we would prefer things to be rather than how things are. And we might see that, for example, in things like if we're going through a grieving process, for example, you know, we wish the situation was different than it actually is, or we wish we didn't lose the person or the thing that was that meant so much to us. But of course, it can happen in any kind of everyday situation where, for example, if someone cuts into your lane in traffic or something like that, it can be a sort of rejection, even of something as simple as that. Where do you think the difficulty with acceptance comes from? When we talk to people about acceptance and working toward that place where we can recognize that life isn't always going to be as we would like it to be, what do you think sort of adds to that resistance? So even when people become aware of what you just spoke about, what do you think adds to that resistance of this concept of acceptance?
Well, the one about the cutting into the traffic is a good example, right? Someone cuts in front of you and you get really upset about it. And this is well known that traffic is one of the most difficult areas in life to keep your cool, right? Because people do crazy things in traffic. Yeah. This is one of the reasons that monks, we don't drive, because we don't want to lose our cool in traffic. No, no, that's actually not the case. But so the question then is, well, when that situation happens, one of the reasons why we get upset is because, well, we think people shouldn't behave this way. We have this idea of the norm for kind of appropriate behavior in the world there. But that is where we go wrong. We think that somehow the rest of humanity or the rest of the world thinks in the same way that we do. But actually, they don't. And they have their own reasons for cutting in. Yeah, it might be that they're really late. They're really pressured. They had a bad day. They're grumpy. There's always a reason. And And one of the things to understand is that once you kind of get into the mind of someone else, if you were able to be in their mind, you would understand why they do that. And the moment you understand, at that moment, acceptance becomes possible. So it is about trying to kind of to recognize not only an individual situation, but understand this as a universal principle that people always have a reason for what they do. There is, you know, they don't do things because they want to, just because they want to upset you or whatever. Actually, that might happen as well, but that is not the usual reason, right? And as soon as we get that, as soon as we understand, then we can accept. There is this old saying, which sometimes is made fun of, but I think actually there's a lot of truth to it. It's a French saying, which says, you know, something like, tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner, to understand all is to forgive all. And there's a lot to that, because once you are in another person's mind state, at that moment, you can understand their motivation for doing exactly what they did. So this is the first reason, you know, first way of kind of coming to acceptance is to understand that there's always a reason. Actually, we need more compassion in the world. We need to more empathy to stand in the shoes of another person, to understand where they're coming from. As the moment we do that, that moment we will get it. The other reason that we get it wrong is that we often think that we are in charge of our life. This is very closely connected to the previous one, the sense that we are in charge, and for that reason we should be doing the right thing because we are in control over our existence. The other person is in control of their existence, so they should be doing things in the right way. They shouldn't be cutting into the traffic. They should restrain themselves or whatever. But of course, the reality is, and this is kind of well known in psychology, it is a Buddhist idea, but it's a general idea that is out there. And that is the idea that we're not really so much in charge of our own lives. We are the end product of a long line of conditioning, a long line of influences working on us in this life, right? Through our upbringing, through our schooling, through our friends, through society in general, through watching silly things on TV. I don't know what it is, all the things that have influenced us. In Buddhism, we also talk about past lives as well being an influence for those people who can relate to that, maybe. And so the choices that we make now in the present, whether that choice is to cut into the traffic or the choice is some other silly thing that we do all the time, that choice is largely conditioned by past experiences. Choices are not really free. Choices are the outcome of the conditioning that works on us. And it is quite hard to see because it feels as if our choices are autonomous, as if they're made by me as a separate individual. But that actually is part of an illusion of how the world isn't really like that. And the more we understand and the more we kind of discover about ourselves that our choices are to a large extent conditioned, the more we come to accept that, well, okay, the other person does what they do, yeah, because actually they are just kind of this, they're almost like a robot in a sense, right? They're following their conditioning. They're following the inner program, which has been written into them over a long, long period of time. That's why they cut into the traffic. And the moment you kind of see that moment, again, gives rise to the potential for understanding, for acceptance, for compassion, for all of these beautiful qualities to arise. Anyway, there you are.
Would that apply to, I mean, we talk about external circumstances and the world around us. Would that apply also to the inner states as well? So, for example, you might get people who will say things like, you know, I feel depressed, or I feel anxious, or I feel stressed, or whatever it might be. I don't want to feel like this. I shouldn't feel like this. Or perhaps maybe people have some relational issues with parents or with partners, and they might feel some kind of resentment or some kind of negative emotion toward that person. And they will say, well, I shouldn't feel like this. There's a sort of rejection of whatever arises inside. And I remember, I don't know where this came from, but I remember reading somewhere that acceptance isn't so much about wanting what you have or what you feel, but it's about coming to terms with what's arising within you. And of course, Jon Kabat-Zinn, the mindfulness teacher, wrote a book called Wherever You Go, There You Are. There's no escaping yourself. But I'm just wondering, again, from a Buddhist perspective, how would you begin to deal with that? So, you know, again, you mentioned earlier about people having this idea of how the world should be, but I think we also internalize that as well. This is how I should be. This is how I should feel.
Yeah.
Or this is how I should think. How do we begin to deal with that sense of sort of rejection or denial within ourselves?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is kind of an extension of what I was saying before about the idea that we are conditioned. Of course, the world around us is conditioned. Other people are conditioned, but it equally applies to us. And so that conditioning, again, is very profound and very deep. And the more you kind of get this idea of conditioning, that the person you are now, the thoughts you have now, the reactions you have now to the world around you, to your family, to your in-laws, to the traffic situation, to the grief you may have, something goes wrong in your life, all of these things are conditioned responses. And really, it's not so much in our power to reject them and say, I don't want to have, we can say I don't want to have them, but it doesn't really help, you know, it's not kind of going to do anything. Yeah. And so you, instead, the moment you understand that these are conditioned responses, again, there comes an acceptance of these things. Yes, ideally, maybe you want to get rid of those, but also to understand that this is the human condition. This is what we are like. This is how we respond to the world. And because we are human beings, we should actually expect these things to happen. Yeah, generally speaking, we should expect these things to happen. And the moment you expect it to happen, and the moment you understand that it is a result of conditioning, at that moment, you can accept it. But of course, the point here is not so much that you accept it and don't do anything about it. This is kind of two different things. Yeah, we can still do something about it. The point is that if you don't accept it, if you reject it, if you get angry because of your anger, right, or you kind of are in denial about all of this, actually you make the situation worse, because all of this judgment of yourself, all the rejection that you have, all the anger that you put on top of existing problems, it actually clouds your mind. It gives you more vested interest. It gives you less ability to see clearly. So if you are able to accept the situation as it is, actually you get more clarity in the mind. That clarity in the mind allows you to see the problem that is actually arising, that understand the causality, why you reacted the way you reacted. Why did I react so negatively to my family? I love my family. Yeah, these are wonderful people. Why do I react to this in this way? And then you kind of can see the causality. And the moment you see the causality, the solution also arises, how to get out of this. So this idea that we should always... The negative reaction actually stops us from taking the right course of action. Yeah, it stops our natural wisdom to understand what is going on. So it's incredibly counterproductive. So instead, be cool, stand back, evaluate what is going on. Why do I react like this? And if you can do that, you have won 90% of the battle. And then all you have to do is to kind of look for the solution and guide your mind in a different direction, and then eventually down the track with a bit of reconditioning, you may find a solution to the problem.
How would someone, I mean, I can imagine maybe some listeners thinking, okay, that all sounds good and well, but how would I even begin to start that process? I mean, maybe we can have a bit of a plug for things like meditation here or contemplation. How would someone practically begin that process? Let's say that they've had the years of conditioning, they've been sort of operating on autopilot, as many of us do for so many years. What kind of things can they begin to do in a practical sense to start understanding those automatic reactions and causalities that you just described?
I suppose that a lot of this has to do with how you reflect on your life. I mean, the fact that someone is coming to your podcast, Sandy, is a good start, right? They're doing pretty good already. It means you have an interest in this area, and having an interest is really kind of the primary thing that is going to make a change in your life. And so there's a couple of things you can do. I mean, you suggested meditation practice, and meditation is, one way of dealing with this, especially the kind of meditation that is taught often in the mindfulness movement, where you just learn to stand back, you learn to accept phenomena for what they are, and you learn to kind of, instead of being involved with everything in your mind, pushing things around, trying to think this, trying not to think that, you just allow all the content of your mind to be. And that is a good starting point to learn to stand back and see things. But often that is good in its own right, but often even reflection is useful, right? And this is what we're doing now. I mean, this kind of interview is like an extended reflection on how the mind works, how to deal with the mind. And so we need to bring these ideas back into our mind all the time. You know, okay, so my family is like this, and my partner is like this. I get upset when they do that. And then just remind yourself that actually that upset is completely counterproductive, because all it does, it kind of entangles you even more with the other person. It clouds your own judgment as to what is the right thing to do. It has no benefits whatsoever. It makes the relationship worse because you kind of, you know, you get upset with them or whatever. Everything just gets worse. So after a while, when this sinks in, because you reflect on it, actually your automatic behavioral pattern itself changes. So I would say it is a matter of reflecting on these things. It is a matter of taking a bit of time out, doing a little bit of meditation, getting a bit more personal time. It is often when we have personal time that we see the world more clearly. If you are around people all the time, it kind of makes it very hard to see clearly. And this then, this kind of, all of these things together somehow will then kind of gradually move you in the right direction. But it is important, you know, one of the kind of things in Buddhism that, you know, if you ask where does the Buddhist path come from, where does the idea of meditation come from, where does the idea of morality come from? And the Buddha, according to the Buddha, it comes from having the right kind of friends. Yeah, having the, if you have good friends in life, they will guide you in the right direction. Yeah, so take people who have an insight into the mind. Yeah, people have an understanding of things. Take them to be your friends. It could be a good psychologist. Yeah, or someone who has an interest in these areas. Your podcast could be maybe, you know, a good kind of place to go. It could perhaps be a Buddhist monk, yeah, someone who has an insight into their own mind, or not necessarily a monk, but maybe a fellow Buddhist or someone around, or just any ordinary people who have an insight or understanding in one's life. So choosing who one takes to be one's friends, companions, who one listens to in the world is actually incredibly important, because these will condition you and your mind will change accordingly. And so I would say in many, many ways, perhaps this is the most important thing of all. And that is precisely why we're having this conversation, because this is like the starting point, yeah, for change to happen. So we need to recondition ourselves. And this is really how it happens, I think. Yeah.
I quite like your point, Ajahn, on the importance of having good people around you and good friends, because I think quite often we always talk about working on ourselves or you know, self-care, and quite often it can appear as though we are encouraged to be isolating or just, you know, working in a solo effort on ourselves. But actually, when we surround ourselves with people who, like you say, they have maybe some understanding of the mind or they have some interest in helping to bring out the best in you and helping you to see the best in yourself as well, I think that can often help with things like self-criticism, self-judgment, that can often be in a cycle, right, that reinforces these negative messages about ourselves sometimes. But you also mentioned as well that when we engage, let's say, in mindfulness meditation, that we can take a step back and we can observe what's going on. How do you explain to people who might, and I've heard this said before, when people say, well, that's fine to engage in mindfulness meditation and take a step back, but are you really just not, is that not the same thing as resignation, that you're just kind of seeing what comes up and you're sort of leaving it as it is? And how is that any different to just being resigned to whatever arises? How would you respond to that?
I would respond to that to say that this is not the end of the path just to observe things. It's actually the beginning of things. It's a beginning of change. And so by observing things, by being able not to react, we can actually get some very valuable information about how we work. Normally, we don't get that information because we obscure it by our reactions, by the way we kind of we deny it, or we think we can control it or whatever. And all of this denial and all this kind of control, which really is an aspect of delusion from a Buddhist point of view, stops us in really understanding what is going on. So understanding what is going on is actually a prerequisite for being able to take corrective action and moving in the right direction. And so our first step is to learn non-reactivity. That's already a very useful learning experience. Yeah. So this is already something we don't normally do in ordinary life. So in that sense, it already has a powerful effect on our mind. And then secondly, from learning not to react, learning to observe, again, this is where we learn where this problem is. And once you know the problem, of course, then you also know the solution. Yeah, this is what the doctor does. It finds the problem, then it says, okay, this kind of medicine will counteract that. And this is exactly the same thing with the mind. It's the, you know, very often the Buddhist path is likened to the idea of how a doctor works. Yeah, you have the problem, which is suffering, and then you have the cause of the suffering, you have the end of the suffering, and then you have the path that leads to the end of suffering, which is like the medicine. And so all of these things with meditation practice, which have the root in Buddhism, are similar kind of things. Yeah, they give you the input that makes you understand the causes. And then once you understand the cause, you can take the corrective action in that particular case. You know, one of the issues that I've had with the mindfulness movement is that it is not really sufficient in its own right. So we start with a mindfulness movement. That is kind of a good beginning point. It gives us some information about what we should be doing. But we need to add other things. We need to add working more directly with the mind, understanding the mind, being wise about who we are as human beings. And then we actually develop the mind through intention, through observing, and then also through intentional reconditioning of who we are as human beings. And all of these things come together, including ethics and morality and kindness. Kindness is a very, to my mind, a very powerful idea and concept. And once you understand that, actually a lot of life really comes together in the idea of kindness, together with mindfulness, and all of these things coming together, that's when you get a powerful path. So not to take things in isolation, I think, is also a very important part of the what we're looking at here.
So it's really about being aware of what's going on and then using that as a starting point, in a sense. I think I've described it before as, you know, if you imagine that you trip and fall in the middle of the road, you don't stay there and dwell and beat yourself up and criticize yourself and wonder how you got there and who caused it and so on. You would sort of take stock of the situation. Okay, I've fallen and I need to get up and move myself to get to, you know, the other side of the road to be safe, right? I don't want to be run over. Yeah. And to me, it's that sense of, okay, recognizing your situation, recognizing what's going on. And then where do I go from here? It's similar to, I mean, you mentioned the mindfulness movement, but I think there's a lot in mental health as well, where there's a lot of great conversation in terms of how to sit with your feelings, how to accept your emotions, that your emotions are valid. But quite often the sort of the point stops there. You know, it's like, well, you sit with your emotions. And of course, the next question would be, well, okay, but then what would I do with it then? And right. and I think, I mean, your French is obviously far better than mine, but I think the French root term for emotion is something like to move or to motivate or to, you know, to take action sort of thing. So when you can reach a point where you can say, okay, this is my situation, then what, you know, what's the next step? And I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but in Buddhism there's this conversation about how mindfulness is just one element of a series of factors that add to, you know, living well, understanding the mind, taking helpful action, etc. That when we just focus on acceptance alone or mindfulness alone, then that's where we might get stuck.
Indeed, it is. I mean, in Buddhism, we have the concept of the idea of the so-called Noble Eightfold Path, right? So it has eight factors, and mindfulness is only one of those eight factors. And so the idea that you can kind of assume that you will be successful in your meditation or successful with, you know, on this path without the other factors is obviously not the way Buddhism thinks about it. And I think this is why the mindfulness movement sometimes has come up against very clear limits as to what can be done through mindfulness. And they have understood, actually, if we're going to be successful, we have to take in some of these other factors of the path as well. And so this is kind of the problem when you secularize things. And this is kind of the idea behind the mindfulness movement. John Kabat-Zinn, he realized fairly on that the mindfulness-based stress reduction was only going to work if it was secularized. It didn't have any religious overtones. He was afraid of the religious overtones. And, you know, we live in a secular world, and I kind of get that. I mean, I was a very secular person myself before I became a Buddhist monk. I was an atheist for most of my life until I became a Buddhist. But the point is that if you believe in the framework of Buddhism, if you believe in the aspect of mindfulness, it means that you should probably take seriously also some of the other aspects. Yeah, otherwise you're kind of, if you believe this is going to work, well, you're going to have to look at the overall framework. Yeah? And the rest, a large part of the rest of the framework, two very important factors, is the idea of right view, looking at the world in the right way. And secondly, the idea of morality, to live morally. And so living morally is actually very challenging. If you want to live morally in a very deep sense, yeah, in the way you think about things and the way you treat people in everyday life, it is a very, very challenging thing. Most people like to think of themselves as good people, and they are. I mean, I'm not suggesting they're not, but we can always take that a bit further. We can become even better people. And this is what this really is about. And so you want to purify, you want to do the best in terms of kindness in the world, avoiding the bad things. Then you do the meditation, you do the mindfulness movement. That gives you additional input into where you are going wrong. Yeah, it gives an additional idea. My mind is misbehaving, I'm getting angry for this reason. Well, why am I thinking like this? Here is an alternative way of thinking. They don't know what they're doing, these people, anyway. They are trapped in their own life. They're trapped in their own habits. Actually, I should have compassion for them instead of being angry with them, right? Suddenly that comes to your mind. And the moment you understand that compassion is the right response, rather than anger, rather than rejection, rather than pushing them away, at that moment, it's a kind of a change in the outlook in your entire consciousness that's incredibly profound and incredibly powerful. It's like, wow, this is the way to look at the world. And the moment you can do that with one person, then you can also do it with yourself, and you can gradually do it with the whole world. And this is how you kind of overcome some of these negative traits of rejecting others or judging them or getting angry with them or irritated or whatever, because you start to see things in an entirely new way. And so all of these things kind of come together beautifully in this sense.
How would you describe the transformation of being able to think like that, to perceive yourself and the world around you like that, when you reach a point of acceptance? And of course, maybe we don't get it right all the time because we're still human, and you know, we're likely to have moments of lapsing. But how would you describe the transformation, how you see the world differently when you can let go of those things that really hinder acceptance?
Yeah, so this is a very important point, and this really has to do with the idea of right view, yeah, seeing things. And the right view here means seeing the world the way the world actually is and not in the way that we want it to be. This is kind of the idea of right view. And so you can see this in many different levels, but one level, for example, would be just the world outside of us. The world outside goes, we're seeing the wars going on in Ukraine. We're seeing climate change around the world, yeah, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And many people are really concerned about that. They might get depressed about these things, et cetera. And so one of the ways of dealing with this is simply to understand that the world is inherently changeable. Yeah, the world is changeable. We should always expect the world to change. And if you expect the world to change, and when there is a war in Ukraine, when there is climate change, instead of blaming other people for being, you know, polluting or for not restraining their greed, etc., you understand, well, this is actually probably the way the world is. Yes, we should do our best to overcome it, but we may not be able to overcome it because change is inherent to the way the world is. So this is kind of the first thing, just reflecting on the nature of change. We want the world to be in a certain way because we want to hold on to the things that we are used to, our ideas of the world, our sense of safety and all of these things. But actually, the world may not be the way we want it to be. And then the second thing I think to understand about this is that change is always difficult. But when we come out the other end of the change, then normally we are able to deal with it. We're able to somehow come through the change on the other side. Yeah. And then once the change has gone through, then okay, then we are okay again. But it's actually just the process or the looking forward to it that we find very hard. We know from, I think, from psychology, and you can probably, back me up on this, Sandy, but is that you know, people have very traumatic experiences, someone dies in the family or they get very sick or whatever, for a while their life is terrible, but then after a while, you know, after they've had become paralyzed or they kind of lose a leg or whatever, after a while, a few months, a year or whatever, they come back to normal again, they find the balance again. It is the change that is hard, but the mind always kind of finds a new balance afterwards. And then you, that is more like when you accept the situation, gradually acceptance will happen. And so just this idea that you know that you will be able to come out the other end, and at the other end, you will be fine. Just remembering that actually from other people's experience means that we don't see that change that is coming, the climate change, the war, whatever it might be. We don't see it in quite the same way. We know that there is something more at the other side. Even though life may be quite different, we know that somehow we will adapt, we will adjust to the situation, and we will be able to kind of carry on in this particular way. And so we are able to deal with it, and we're able to come to that point where we can accept these things. You know, then there's this idea that you're talking about, what is the process that allows you to come to compassion rather than anger? Yeah, how does this actually happen in reality? And the way that it happens is, again, you have to reflect on how conditioned you are as a person, right? Understanding that conditioning. And the more you see how conditioned you are, the more ability you have to see other people as conditioned. And then eventually that will give rise to this moving away from blaming and coming towards compassion. And one example of this would be that if you look at yourself, who you were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever it might be, depending on how old you are. And then you kind of look at yourself at that time, 20 years ago or whatever, you felt that you were autonomous. You were able to make decisions for yourself. You were in charge of your life. You made decisions. Maybe you went to university or you chose your first job or you chose a partner for life. And they felt like kind of my decisions. But to me, when I look back at all the decisions I made, I mean, I decided at one point to become a Buddhist monk. And I decided to go to university and all of these decisions. And the more even though at the time it seemed like an independent decision, the further distance I have from that point in time, the more it seems like it's a chain of events that had a certain momentum of their own. And it wasn't so much a decision, it was more like me just following a certain stream, a certain pattern that was already laid down. And I was just making decisions based on that pattern, based on that conditioning, based on those habits, based on the pressures of society, based on whatever. And that is how it seems in retrospect. And then we can extrapolate that to the present situation. We can say that, well, now too, it feels like I'm making autonomous decisions. But quite likely, it was just like it was 20 years ago. I'm actually just following all of these influences working on me. And my choices are really an outcome of all of these things. And once you start to think about life in this way, you stop blaming people. You start to see, actually, they too are just like me. They are conditioned in this way. And it's like the light bulb goes on inside, that this conditioning is very profound. The feeling of being independent, making independent decisions, is largely an illusion. This is one of those kind of profound Buddhist teachings as well. The feeling of having freedom of choice is largely an illusion. We are conditioned beings. And I think any modern psychologist will tend to agree with that. And so the more you reflect on that, the more that becomes true, then one day you will no longer be able to blame that other person. And you will think, actually, they need my compassion. They are trapped. They are trapped by the conditions around them. They are trapped by their own past. They are trapped by all the habits that they have. They are trapped by, if you like, their personality. The personality that we have now, can we step out of that personality and be someone else? No, you are stuck with your personality, right? This is your personality, you're stuck with that. And that will make you act in certain ways because that's what personalities do. That is kind of how we deal with the world, essentially. So I think it's just a matter of reflecting in these ways. And as you do that, gradually you come to a different way of thinking about things.
As you were talking there, Ajahn, I got the sense that you were describing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I got the sense that you're describing this idea that our life is always happening within context. So our environment, our upbringing, our relationships and so on that are all influential, quite often to the point where we don't necessarily recognize it at the time. And so to make choices and decisions consciously within that context is something that we're always doing. But one question I thought that might come up, again, if I put myself in the shoes of some listeners, they might sort of come back to that and say, well, does that not just mean that your life is determined? You know, I mean, you became a Buddhist monk. I think you trained in engineering, right? So if I remember correctly, so you didn't end up as an engineer. So if you take this idea that you were making decisions along the way, like following the stream, I can imagine someone saying, well, then how can you ultimately help the decisions that you make? How can you come to a place of acceptance, but also still retaining that agency of making conscious decisions in your life? Because if I'm someone, for example, who is depressed or who is indecisive or who's always anxious, is that not just going to be the way I'm always going to be because of my context? How can I sort of differentiate myself from the context of my life?
Yeah, first of all, I'm still an engineer, you know, I'm an engineer of the mind. That's when the Buddhist turn. No, I'm just... So the point here is that if you just follow along your natural inclinations, if you just follow along with what you feel like doing right now, and kind of then, of course, your conditioning of the past is what determines your choice. Yeah, so you kind of follow along, you just allow things to go the way they are. But if you stop and you try to be mindful about what is going on, yeah, you don't just kind of allow things to go the way they feel like, but you allow also the input in the present. And that's kind of the difference. One thing is all the conditioning from the past, but there's also an input right here and right now in the present. And if you stop and you're mindful and you ask yourself, well, how can I think differently about this? Is there an alternative way? Should I act differently? Should I say something else? What is the wise thing? What would a wise person have done in this case? Whoever it is that you take as a wise person in your life, how would they think about this situation? At that moment, you're allowing new input to shape kind of how you do things in the world. You're not just allowing the past to determine everything. And so this is kind of the trick. And then you're allowing wisdom to arise in the present moment. And so even though we are shaped to a large extent by the past, there's always room for new input to come in. Yeah, and we know that. And then what you're doing is that you are reshaping your habits. One of the most difficult things in life is precisely to reshape our habits, because habits tend to be very strong. That's why they're called habits. Yeah, we just do them again and again. And it takes a lot of mindfulness to be able to reshape those things. But if you keep that mindfulness going and you keep working at it, then that depression, that anxiety, all of those things, they may very well, at the very least, they may decrease. You may overcome them. You may be able to develop joy, yeah, and happiness in the place of those negative qualities. And so these things are possible, but it takes a sense of, you know, standing back a little bit, not allowing yourself to judge yourself on those things, but standing back, watching, understanding the causality, taking new action. This is where mindfulness comes, and then gradually undoing and unraveling that conditioning, putting in place new conditioning, in line with what is sensible, a new way of thinking about things, not blaming yourself. One of the things that we should talk about maybe, Sandy, is, we talked about compassion before, but I think one of the very powerful things in life is the idea of self-compassion, having it towards oneself. And this ties in very much with this idea that our autonomy, our ability to make individual decisions are actually quite limited. And once you understand that you are, you know, as we say here, we are kind of very much a product of our past, the more you get that, the more you also have compassion for yourself, because you realize that instead of judging yourself, you realize that you are a little, not entirely trapped, but you are a little bit trapped by the past. And so that idea of understanding that, even your bad qualities, whatever it might be, yes, they come out, but they come out because of causes in the past. That moment you can have compassion for yourself instead of judging yourself. And the moment you have compassion for yourself for the suffering you may have, for the even the negative things that you do in your life, etc., etc., at that moment again, you are opening up the potential for change. You're no longer being hard on yourself. You're no longer blocking the clarity of your mind, as I mentioned before. So self-compassion is a very, very powerful idea, because it opens up an alternative view of how you should deal with life, etc., etc.
It's interesting that you raise this practice of self-compassion, because I noticed that there's some dogs barking outside, so I'm trying to practice acceptance. But you mentioned this practice of self-compassion, and I'm wondering how you would advise or guide someone who might say things like they don't deserve self-compassion, or that if they begin to practice self-compassion, then they'll become complacent, or they'll sort of self-involved. There's this real reluctance to be kind toward ourselves, because there's this sense that either we are undeserving, or that it's going to make us very sort of big-headed and self-centered.
Yeah, I think that's a misunderstanding, and I hear that objection all the time when I talk about these things. So it's kind of fascinating that you bring it up. But I think it's the other way around. Self-compassion is a gentle feeling. It is not a big-headed feeling at all. It's a feeling of, it's kind of a soft and gentle thing. And, in Buddhism, we often talk about not just about self-compassion, but we talk about rejoicing in our good qualities, our generosity, our kindness, and all of these kind of things. And all of these things could, in principle, make you big-headed. But again, the idea is that if you know that you have done something kind, it's not about bragging to the world that I have done something. And that would be negative, right? If you go bragging, yeah, I'm the best. Yeah, look at all these other scallywags. I'm the kind of the good person or whatever. That, of course, is bad. But if you have a kind of warm feeling inside because you know that you are living well, that is not bragging to anyone. That is just a positive feeling that you know you're living your life well. And so with all of that, when we do something good, it is okay to feel good about yourself, right? It is okay to feel the warm feeling inside. It is not about ego. It is just about a positive self-image. And that positive self-image comes from living well. And the same thing with self-compassion is just an acknowledgement that life is difficult. Life is hard for most people. We have problems, we have issues that we have to deal with. Everyone has to deal with the world not going the way it is supposed to be. Everyone has to deal with death of their loved ones. Everyone has to deal with sickness in their own body. And it is generally out of our control. These things are just the way the world works. And so if we don't have self-compassion, if we start blaming ourselves or others for these things, actually, it just makes the problem worse. This is the reality. The world is like this. There's no one to blame, really. It's just the way the world works. And so, again, this comes back to this idea that if you're able to just observe, right, instead of reacting, very often the reactions that we have, we say, okay, I must be upset with myself, because when I'm upset with myself, then I will do something. But it is actually a very weak kind of doing. It is a doing based on anger. It is kind of a reluctant kind of doing. It is like a slave driver kind of whipping you into shape or whatever. And you do it reluctantly. But actually, no, you want to do this thing not because you are forced to through anger or ill will, etc., etc. You want to act because you know this is a good thing to do. You know that you want to move away from these negative qualities. And so to do that and to do it effectively, because anger, again, distorts your outlook, distorts your ability to see what is really going on, you need to stand back. Don't react to these things. Don't become angry. When you have self-compassion, your mind is going to be cool. You're going to have a warm feeling towards yourself and hopefully to others as well. And when you have that, then you will be able to see what the problem is. Then you will be able to make good corrective measures that are not distorted but based on reality, and then you actually will make you will go forward, and that kind of change is sustainable. Anger is not really sustainable. You can't always go around being angry with yourself. It's kind of crazy. We spend the whole life, it's actually just a habit, right? We think that we are choosing to get angry with ourselves because we're doing bad things, but actually we're not choosing at all. We're just habitually doing this because we were taught by our parents or taught by our society or whatever. And so we justify it by saying, oh, it's good because then we become better. But actually, no, the reason we do it is usually because we have been conditioned to do these things. And so we need to rethink a new and better and improved way. And that way is self-compassion. And then you start to be able to actually make some real progress in your life. Self-compassion is not the same as complacency. Complacency means you don't care, right? But you want to care in the right kind of way. You want to care from a place of wisdom rather than from a place of judgment or anger.
Yeah, so self-compassion is not about, as some people might phrase it, giving yourself a free pass or ignoring unhelpful behaviors or you know, just dismissing anything that we're doing that might be unhelpful, but it's about taking like you mentioned, a more gentle approach to how we deal with that. Maybe I've heard sometimes it be said that imagine how you would treat a friend or a best friend, with your experiences. But I wonder whether it might be more helpful sometimes to imagine someone that you're mentoring, because maybe with a friend we can be a bit too kind sometimes, or a bit maybe too permissive or too forgiving. But I like to think of it as, well, imagine you had someone who's younger than you and you're mentoring them. So you wouldn't necessarily give them a free pass and say, well, it doesn't matter what you do, it's just be kind to yourself. You might highlight certain unhelpful traits or behaviors, but instead of really chastising and criticizing, you would maybe say, well, what's the effects of this behavior or chain of events, and how might we approach it differently? How might we learn from this in that sense?
Absolutely. I think that's very, very much to the point. Yeah, if you get angry with the other person or whatever, they often become defensive and they don't, they're not really able to see the problem. They're not even able to resolve it properly. They don't understand what's going on. But if the other person, I think this is kind of one of the critical things, if the other person feels that you have their best interest at heart when you tell them these things, if they feel actually, Sandy is telling me this because he wants me to be happy, not because he is, upset about the world or he's upset with me or whatever. He's saying this because he wants me to be happy and he wants the other person to be happy. So maybe I should listen to this. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, if you want to ever give advice to somebody, you should never give advice when you're angry, because people will not take it on board. Give it when you feel cool, yeah? And you really do have a sense of compassion and understanding for the person who does something bad, but also for the perpetrator, yeah, for the person who does something wrong. Yeah, you have compassion for both because you understand they're both kind of trapped in some kind of unhelpful habits or unhelpful relationship, and that is kind of what makes it problematic. Yeah, and so this is what you point out. Okay, listen, when you act like this, then it causes suffering for the other person, but if you think differently, maybe you can help the other person, or whatever it is, and then you kind of come out of it. One of the things that I have noticed is, very often we are so much kind of bound by other people's praise and blame and how other people treat us, and we get very upset if other people treat us badly, and we feel very happy when people treat us well or whatever. But we need to, one of the things that we really need to do is get out of this whole idea of worrying too much about what other people, whether they praise us or blame us, because a lot of the time other people's praise and blame doesn't really have any value because they don't really understand. Yeah, they are also blinded in their own way. They have their own vested interests and biases. And so I always ask myself, well, the Buddha, would the Buddha blame me? Would the Buddha praise me in this particular situation, right? In other words, someone who is really, really wise, how would they act in this particular situation? And when you are a Buddhist monk such as me, then you live with certain people who are also very wise because their meditation is profound, they have an insight into the human mind, etc. And what you find is that they're almost invariably kind to you. Yeah, they never really blame you. And if they blame you, they say, well, they take you aside, say, well, listen, this is not working properly. Let's see if we can change this somehow and go in a different direction for this reason or that reason. There's always a feeling that they're doing it because of kindness, because they're looking after you and looking after others at the same time. And so And so this is the thing. So once we kind of, we don't take the praises and the blames of the world too seriously, yeah? And we don't really kind of think about things in that way. Yeah? And we listen to those people who really have a sense of wisdom, and those people who have our interest at heart, yeah? And kind of then this whole thing starts to come together in a beautiful way. And we also try to treat other people in the same way. Yeah? We try to kind of understand in a more deeper way the human conditioning. And as we do that, these things tend to come together.
I'm thinking about how we begin to put this in practice. And maybe just on a final point, Ajahn, if you can share maybe one or two practical steps that people can take away and begin to apply to their lives. Something that came up to mind earlier for me was that, especially in Malaysia, I mean, you've been in Malaysia quite a few times by this point, so you'll know that the traffic jams and the roads can be quite busy, and you know, people might be cutting in or they don't allow you to cut in. And so it can give rise to all these kind of emotions. So I think I heard some years ago, I think it was a Buddhist monk talking about a traffic jam and saying that, you know, we always see other people around us as being part of the traffic jam, but we don't see ourselves as being part of the jam. So can we be just as kind to other people as they might be to, or we would want them to be to us? So I'm thinking, well, maybe one thing that we could do is if someone does cut in front of us, or if they don't let us into the lane or whatever it might be, then maybe one simple practice might be to think, right, okay, you know, I notice that I'm feeling a bit angry here, but you know, maybe that person is in a rush, maybe they're having an emergency, maybe they're not focusing because they've had a sleepless night or whatever it might be. But just to have that sort of awareness might be a good step to cultivating this sort of acceptance, this compassion for others and ourselves as well. Do you have any other practical tips that you might like to share?
Yeah, that's a good one. Oh, you know, always recognizing that there's always a reason why people do what they do. There's always a reason. And once you kind of, sometimes we have to know the specific reasons to be able to have that kind of view. But sometimes we can also just universalize it and say there's always a reason. Another thing that someone mentioned a long time ago is the, you know, when you are traveling in traffic, there's also a good chance to listen to something nice while you're traveling, listen to something wise, listening to someone, you know, who you trust to have a kind of worldview that is very supportive of leaning you in the right direction to become a better person. And it's amazing what that does to your mind. When you listen to someone while in traffic who has this idea of kindness, you actually become more kind in the traffic because you are leaning in that direction. So use that time wisely, yeah? Instead of listening to the radio, listening to music or whatever. I mean, that's fine as well, whatever you want to do, but sometimes listen to something that actually is more, develops the mind in a kind of direction, something more psychological, something that helps you become a better human being. This is the kind of conditioning that we need a lot. So using that in traffic is, I think, very, very important. That is one thing that you can do. You know, a general sense that, a general idea that people are what they are. They don't have all that much ability to control their lives. You know, that for me, I always use this idea that, you know, people do what they do for a reason. They do that because they are. And it's not, one of the things that I often tell myself is that it's not personal. The reason why you get angry in traffic is because we take it personally. This person is cutting in front of me. Yeah, if they had cut in front of someone else, if you see them in the mirror cutting in front of the guy behind you, you couldn't care less. Yeah, you would never get upset at all. But it's because they're cutting in front of you that is the issue. Yeah? But it's important to remember that these things are not personal. Yeah, they are not. It's not because of you that this person is cutting in there. It is just a kind of the way things work. It's the way. It's the They are just acting out of their own inner drive. And that is really the issue here. And once you depersonalize things in life and you understand that actually it is not your problem, it is the other person's problem. They are the one that are driven to do stupid things, whether it's cutting in front of someone, saying something bad, doing something bad. It is their problem, not your problem. At that moment, instead of getting upset, again, it allows compassion to arise for the other person. This is very powerful in situations where someone speaks to you in a bad way and you feel that they are kind of targeting you or whatever. In that situation, again, remember, it is not personal. they are not doing this against you. If another person had been there in your place, they would have to receive the same words, the same kind of negativity. Yeah, the problem is not you. The problem is the inner conditioning of the other person who is speaking. They are speaking in this way because of all the things coming together in this way. Yeah? And so they are the one who have the problem, not really you. Yeah? You may have the problem for a short while because you have to be in the presence. Yeah? But then you know that, well, this is the way the world is. There's always going to be people who treat you in this way. And so you kind of come back to this idea of acceptance again. Yeah, the world is like this. There are always people who are going to say unpleasant things. Okay, fair enough. This person is saying something unpleasant. What do I expect? And then coming to that acceptance, then understanding that actually the other person has a problem because they are speaking in a bad way because of their own conditioning. Not only don't you take it personally, but you have compassion for the other person at that point because you know they are trapped in a very negative and bad habit. And so there's a beautiful thing because in so much of our life, we are trapped in our own little bubble. Yeah, this is me and my life. The big bad world is out there, yeah, and everyone is evil and its politics are bad and people are doing bad things and all of these kind of things. And we kind of feel isolated. And the more we judge other people, the more we judge the political scene, the more isolated we feel because we retreat into our own little personal world, yeah, me against everyone else. And that's a very unpleasant place to be. So instead of retreating into our own personal world like that, if we can have more compassion for the whole world, for all the people, for society at large, including ourselves, then instead of creating this boundary between us and everyone, we start dissolving that boundary. And when that boundary dissolves and we start to have compassion for everyone, it's a very beautiful and powerful mental state. Yeah. Instead of feeling fearful, instead of feeling that we are up against the world, we actually embrace everyone around us. And this is the kind of the goal, in a sense, of all this compassion practice, all this kindness practice, is the idea of embracing everyone in the world. A little bit of that will go a long way here. But the further you go, the more you kind of open up yourself to the world around you in this way. And eventually you actually create a very, you change yourself. You become gradually become a different person. And one day you realize, wow, this is just amazing. This is wonderful. Yeah, things are really changing. I thought I had to be like this forever. It turns out you didn't. You could change it. You could make a difference. And now it's all happening in your life.
I think that's a wonderful point to end on, Ajahn, when you mentioned this idea of, you know, sort of dissolving the boundaries and sort of engaging a little bit more with life, with people in a way that's more compassionate toward others, toward ourselves, because otherwise there is this, and we have this sense of more and more people feeling lonely, feeling isolated because of that sort of hard boundary that might be in place. And it might be there for a reason, as you mentioned, but how can we be more aware of that and to take just little steps bit by bit to start to sort of remove that boundary or at least soften it a little, that it doesn't make us feel quite so isolated. But I really enjoyed the conversation as always, Ajahn, and I'm really grateful for your time. I think you've shared quite a lot of valuable insights in terms of how we can start to understand acceptance a bit more, that it's not just about being resigned or sort of just lying back and letting the world do its thing, but that we do have, even within the context of what's happening, we have that resource within us to sort of react and respond in more sort of conscious, helpful ways that hopefully make ourselves feel a bit happier, a bit more connected to the world, as well as having more sort of healthier connections and relationships with others as well. So I really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts today.
Great. Thank you so much, Sandy. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.